Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Last week, a Missouri Court of Appeals vacated the conviction of Ryan Ferguson. Listeners might recall Ferguson as one of the two men accused in the 2001 murder of Columbia Daily Tribune sports editor Kent Heitholt. In its legal opinion, the appeals court said the prosecution violated Ferguson's due process rights by withholding favorable information from the defense team. In this case, it was an interview with the wife of a key witness that could have undermined her husband's testimony. This type of evidence suppression or withholding, which is known as a Brady violation, may be more common than you think. A 1999 Chicago Tribune report on prosecutorial misconduct found that 381 homicide convictions were later vacated because prosecutors hid evidence or allowed witnesses to lie. Today on Intersection, we're taking a closer look at Ryan Ferguson's case and to learn more about Brady violations. Joining me in studio, Bill Ferguson is the father of Ryan Ferguson. For years, he's advocated on his son's behalf. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Rodney Uphoff is a professor in the MU School of Law. Before coming to MU, he taught at the University of Oklahoma College of Law and the University of Wisconsin Law School. Before becoming a law professor, Uphoff was a public defender. Rodney, thanks for joining us.
Welcome to be here.
John Roothouse is a partner in the law firm of Jones, Schneider & Stevens, LLC. He's also worked as a Boone County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney and Assistant Attorney General for the state of Missouri. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
And joining us by phone, Charles Atwell is an attorney with the law firm of Foland, Wickens, Eisfelder, Roper, and Hofer, P.C. Before that, he was a circuit judge in Jackson County. Full disclosure, Atwell also worked with the law firm of Weisrich, Atwell, Merrickin, Lee, and Hobbs, which represented Ryan Ferguson, although Atwell was not directly involved with the case. Charles, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Ryan.
All right. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience as well. What questions do you have about the Ryan Ferguson case? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. So to start, Bill, maybe we'll start with you just in general about this the vacated sentence last week. You had some time for this all to sink in. What's your reaction up front to what happened here and where are you going from here, I suppose?
Well, my immediate reaction is, what took so long? Well, it's taken a decade for something that the case had no merit, as far as we're concerned, initially. And it's taken 9.5 years and numerous appeals just to get to this stage. And to have the sentence vacated is exhilarating, to say the least. So we're very happy.
Yeah. And so what is your attorney, Kathleen Zellner, telling you? What's coming ahead here, though, in the next few weeks and months?
Well, immediately, we don't know when Ryan will actually be released. The sentence is vacated. As a matter of fact, if you pull up his name at the prison, it's non grata. His name is not there. So I'm not sure what that status means. But he's definitely there, and we're hoping that he'll get out Wednesday or Thursday. Earlier would be nice. And then once that happens, it will be up to Kathleen, what our next Kathleen Zellner, our attorney, as to what we do next.
Right. And so for him to be out then, that would have to be because you guys have put in a request for bond at this
point. We did, and that make that decision tomorrow. It was 15, and we had a bond hearing to be held on the Tuesday, 7 days later. And then they have to make a decision. So hopefully he'll either be released completely, unconditionally, or that we'll post a bond.
Sure. We've, again, got a variety of legal experts here as well. For those of you that have read, been following this case, what are your initial reactions to what the court put out, this appeals court last week, and what it said and what it means going forward, too?
Well, I think I should say from the outset that I haven't really followed this case very closely, and this occurred at a time before I worked at the Boone County Prosecutor's Office, so I don't have any inside information for you, unfortunately.
Sure.
But I think in reading the opinion, I think what concerns me is not necessarily the result that was reached. And again, I don't know enough about the case to comment as to whether or not the conviction should have been vacated or not. But I think having worked in a prosecutor's office, having worked with the Attorney General, and seeing some of the language that was included in that opinion, I'm very concerned about what that can mean going forward for the administration of some of these law offices.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, Rodney, too, could you help us a little bit on the process going forward as well? We talked a little bit about that with a bill here, but...
Well, specifically, I guess what John's referring to is the question of Brady and a Brady violation here. And so the opinion is critical of the then district attorney, Mr. Crane, who is now a circuit court judge. But the opinion states very clearly that it felt that this was important exculpatory material that should have been turned over as both a statutory and constitutional matter, and its failure to do so, in the court's view, undermined the court's confidence in the verdict. Because if you look at the opinion, there were really two key witnesses who testified against Ryan Ferguson. The first was Chuck Erickson, the co-defendant. So his testimony was essentially a confession and said, I was involved and Ryan Ferguson was with me. So that was the linchpin of the state's case. But the corroborating witness was the janitor, who essentially said when he came out of the building, he saw two people in the alley. When he first – he said, I saw these two people, but I didn't know who they were. Then his explanation for why it was that he suddenly was able to tell that it was Ryan Ferguson, Chuck Erickson – was he contended that he got a newspaper article while he was in prison. It was folded in a particular way, so he saw the pictures, but there were no names. And as soon as he saw the pictures, he testified at trial, he recognized the two people as the two people were in the alley. And it was only when he unfolded the newspaper did he then claim that he saw that it was Chuck Erickson and Ryan Ferguson, the names connected with the photo. Well, as the opinion lays out, prosecutor sent one of his investigators out to speak with the wife of Jerry Trump, who was this witness. He sent his investigator out to speak to Barbara Trump, and Barbara Trump was asked about sending the newspaper article, and she said, I have no recollection of sending a newspaper article to Jerry Trump. So the investigator should have prepared a report, provided this information to the prosecutor, who in turn, under a case called Brady versus Maryland, this is classic exculpatory material, this material should have been turned over to the defense. Mm. Had it been turned over to the defense, they would have cross-examined Mr. Trump and may well have been able to discredit his testimony. So that's why the court ultimately concluded we're uncomfortable with the final result, because if you strip away Trump's evidence, that leaves only Chuck Erickson's testimony. The court did not say necessarily that it felt, in fact, it did not address the actual innocence claim, but it said, given the Brady violation, we're satisfied that we are not confident in the verdict, and therefore it overturned the conviction. So I think the larger problem identified here is one of the extent to which prosecutors are, in fact, complying with their obligation under Brady to turn over all exculpatory material. Mm. I want to make it clear, and maybe this will reassure John, I think the vast majority of prosecutors do turn over exculpatory material. Mm. But unfortunately, this is becoming all too common where material, not just recently and not just here in Missouri, but across the country, this is a national problem mm-hmm. where we have a certain number of prosecutors who are not living up to their obligations, their professional obligations, sure. and this is causing a problem for our judicial system.
Well, there's a few aspects of that that I would take issue to. I think that's a fair characterization of what the Western District stated in its opinion. However, when I knew I was going to be on this radio program, I read it a little bit more closely the second time. And I think one of the things that really concerns me about this opinion is that there's a glaring factual dispute in this on this particular issue. Mr. Uphoff, you know, just characterized it as Kevin Crane sending an investigator out to talk to Mrs. Trump prior to trial. Well, actually, the testimony of some of the witnesses is that this was a phone call initiated by Mrs. Trump after she was called by Mr. Ferguson here, and this was several months after the trial. And that's a pretty big factual problem to have on something, a legal issue of this significance. I don't know why, and I don't know if the blame lays at the feet of the state for not clarifying the record better, or for the court for maybe not remanding this for more factual proceedings. But it's expressed in a footnote. The decision does acknowledge this factual dispute as to whether or not this contact between an investigator and Mrs. Trump occurred before or after trial. The other issue that the other thing that he mentioned that I think is incorrect is that the record is pretty clear that Mr. Crane had no knowledge of this contact between his investigator.
So it's nothing to be proved.
Right. Yeah. Well, I didn't say that he had any knowledge. I said the investigator failed to turn over the information to him, so
right.
He in turn wasn't able to turn over to.
Yeah, but your statement was that Crane sent him out to talk to Mrs. Trump, and that's not true.
Okay, he just went on his own.
Well, from what I understand, Mrs. Trump contacted the prosecutor's office.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's not the way the opinion reads, and you're right. I don't know what the facts are.
The opinion did go to great lengths to say, and many times, that Kevin Crane may not have known about this investigator and thing. And I guess not really important necessarily in proving that this was a real Brady violation.
Right, absolutely, because Kyles versus Whitley is a United States Supreme Court case that specifically said the police are charged, the district attorney essentially is charged with the knowledge of the police. And the reason that it came out that particular way is because there were cases before, and in fact, famous case out of Chicago, where the police actually had two sets of files. They had a set of files that included all material, and then they had a set of files that didn't exclude any exculpatory material. That was the set of materials that was turned over to the prosecution. And that was the set of materials that was turned over to the defense. So what the court said in Kyles versus Whitley is we can't have prosecutors and police pointing at each other and blaming each other. Bottom line is the state has the obligation, and it's up to the prosecutors to set up appropriate procedures and communication with their police so that the prosecutor is the one ultimately who has possession of all the material, and it's the prosecutor, not the police, who makes the determination of what ought to be turned over. So it's not necessarily I'm not saying that Kevin Crane purposefully withheld this information, but this information was withheld, and neither Kyles nor Whitley requires a showing of bad faith on the part of the defense or part of the prosecution, essentially.
If I could interject here for a moment. If you would go back and examine the testimony of Bill Hulse, his investigator, he clearly states that Crane got out of prison in December. I mean, Crane didn't.
Trump.
Probably a Freudian slip. That Trump got out of prison December of 2004. And at about that time, a year before the trial was 2005, that he contacted Barbara Trump. And numerous contacts, at least two or three. So I would suggest that before we get too carried away in these opinions, that we go back and read the transcript from the habeas hearing, and I think you'll be rather enlightened as to what actually happened from the prosecutor's point of view. And it doesn't match up with what you two gentlemen are saying.
Well, I do take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuelner, and today we're talking about the Ryan Ferguson case. Last week, a court of appeals threw out Ferguson's conviction in the 2001 murder of Columbia Daily Tribune sports editor Kent Heitholt. Today, we're talking about the legal basis for why that conviction was vacated and some of the larger issues surrounding the conduct of prosecutors. Joining me in studio for the conversation today are Bill Ferguson, the father of Ryan Ferguson, Rodney Uphoff, a professor in the MU School of Law and a former public defender, Attorney John Roothouse, who in the past worked as a Boone County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney and as an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Missouri, and joining us by phone, Charles Atwell is a practicing attorney who was formerly a circuit judge in Jackson County. And for you and our audience, do you agree with the Missouri Court of Appeals decision to vacate Ryan Ferguson's conviction? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. We have a lot to talk about today, so I'm going to try to jump into something else real quick here, and that is that on Friday there was a special prosecutor appointed in this case. Just to talk about the timeline and what's going to happen from here, Bill, maybe we'll start with you about what you know, what your attorneys are telling you now about this special prosecutor, what it might mean for the process going forward.
All I know about that is that he'll be making the decision or making the recommendation as to whether or not to have a trial or allow Ryan to be released. That's all I'm aware of.
What about John or Rod or Charles? Anything? What is the state thinking here with making that move? Was that something you saw coming in this situation?
Well, I think it makes perfect sense because there were issues raised, obviously, in the opinion about the conduct of the Boone County Prosecutor's Office. Dan Knight was a member of the office and, in fact, assisted in the case. So I think it was a wise move by Mr. Knight to essentially ask that a special prosecutor come in and make a independent determination as to whether or not to go forward or not.
I agree with that completely. I think given the facts here, it would have been too much of a distraction for the Boone County Prosecutor's Office to try to retry this case again.
Does it mean anything more than that, though, as far as making that switch, as far as the process here and what the state's going to have to be thinking about doing?
Well, it puts the special prosecutor in a particularly difficult position because, and I believe it's a she, has a relatively short period of time to make a decision on whether to go forward. It's a murder case. There was a lot of information that she needs to go through. So, we want her to be able to make a truly independent and wise decision as to whether or not to go forward or not. It's significant not only for Mr. Ferguson, but it's significant for the community, for the Highholt family and everybody else. So that should be a reasoned decision, and most reasoned decisions take more than 10 or 15 days. So she's in a difficult decision. Nonetheless, I think that was definitely the appropriate way to go.
Mm-hmm. The other person that you didn't mention there is Charles Erickson. Could the way this process played out mean anything if he tries to follow this path and get out?
Well,
and
we're going to
talk more about that.
Yeah, but I think we're going to have an interesting discussion on that because I saw Bill indicating that he thinks that this will ultimately lead to an exoneration for Mr. Erickson, and I would say that he and Ryan are in markedly different positions. It is extremely difficult to undo a guilty plea. In this case, Mr. Erickson has given a series of statements or confessions regarding the crime. The one he testified at trial, then he gave a subsequent one, then he gave a subsequent one. There may be three, there may even be four, I'm not sure. But I think that it will be extremely hard for his attorney, if he tries to go forward and brings a motion to withdraw the plea, to establish that the plea was an involuntary plea, and that's what he'll have to do in order to, I think, secure his ultimate release. I'd be curious what John has to say about that, but I think he's sledding uphill in trying to get out.
Or maybe this might be a good time to bring Charles in. Charles, it's harder to bring you in over the phone, but what are your thoughts on this, on the Charles Erickson issue here?
Well, I agree with what Rod said. Is because of the fact of the statements he's made in the guilty plea, it's a much different situation, and it's going to be a much more difficult situation, both in a factual sense and a procedural sense. So, I agree with that comment. I really not in a position and don't care to comment on this case in particular, but I think that one thing that we should note about this case is I think it does show a trend over the last 10 or 15 years. In the state of Missouri, where the Supreme Court has tried to use the vehicle of habeas corpus to address, actual innocence claims or what they call gateway claims, and that was a jurisdiction that was somewhat foreclosed for a long time. And I think with a lot of the exonerations that has occurred from DNA evidence and from other organizations, I think that this, in a procedural sense, is a good thing. And I think this is another case that demonstrates that. And I think it's important that we have some result or some last avenue when there are serious questions of the fairness of the trial or the guilt of the defendant. So I think the court should be complimented in that regard.
This might be a good time to go ahead and start talking more specifically about Brady violations in general. Just maybe if you give us a little bit of background, John, maybe it'd be good to go to you on this, on what Brady violations are. And you know, we're talked a lot about them throughout this first 15 minutes of the show.
Sure. No, Rod gave a really good background of it, I think. You know, I think the classic example of Brady is when there's material that's directly exculpatory as to the either the guilt or the degree of punishment that would be appropriate for a defendant. When that is either suppressed or even if it's inadvertently, it's failed to be disclosed to the defense. I think everybody agrees that under our system of justice and the rights that are afforded under the Due Process Clause, that a defendant is entitled to that information to have a fair trial. And as Mr. Uphoff described before, there are already a lot of the Brady Doctrine has been extended a great deal already. I mean, as he mentioned, it doesn't extend just to the prosecutor or even the prosecutor's staff. It also extends now to law enforcement agencies that may have no contact whatsoever with the prosecutor. It really has nothing to do with misconduct. As he mentioned, it can be inadvertent. It can mm-hmm. There does not have to be bad faith.
And you mentioned we keep throwing around the word exculpatory and material. Could you explain for the non-lawyers in our audience what those words mean and why they're important?
Just going to say, and then the third aspect to which it's been extended is, you know, the example I gave you was directly exculpatory evidence. Mm-hmm. But as this decision shows, it also extends to impeachment evidence, which is not evidence that would directly be exculpatory towards the defendant, but evidence that may discredit one of the state's witnesses or otherwise discredit evidence in the case. And so that's the existing Brady law. So I guess what concerns me about this recent decision is already having an extension of Brady to this degree, to apply it to a relative of a witness who says really nothing more than, you know, I don't recall and I don't want to be a part of this case. As a former prosecutor, I can tell you, we get that comment before every trial, not only from relatives of witnesses, but witnesses themselves. And the information that's being communicated in that statement is not, I don't recall sending a newspaper to somebody. The what's really being communicated there is, I don't want to be a part of this trial. I don't want to get sucked into this. Why are people calling me about this case? So I think that's what concerns me, is that, you know, with the level of Brady protection that's already in place, to see the court extend it this much further, I can't conceive of realistically how a prosecutor's office can follow this decision going forward.
I'd like to speak to that, because I don't see this as somehow an extension of Brady. I think that this is pretty much a run-of-the-mill Brady case. It's not actually on the more egregious end. I would agree with John that this is impeachment evidence, and impeachment evidence is some of the evidence that tends to commonly not be turned over under circumstances where I think the wiser and better course is to turn it over. But this Brady violation is not as significant as the Brady violation that occurred just down in Texas. There's been a newspaper article, media coverage about Ken Anderson, who was a prosecutor down there, and a case that was 25 years old. In that particular case, it wasn't impeachment evidence, but it was evidence, one, a statement by the child, the 3-year-old child at the time, who apparently told the police immediately after the crime that there was a monster, a man with a mustache who came in, and it wasn't Daddy. And that information was not provided to the defense. The defense didn't know anything about that. And the second statement was a statement by a witness who saw a car and a man close in time to the murder at the house. That information wasn't provided. So ultimately, not only did the Texas Court of Appeals overturn the conviction, but ultimately it led to the disbarment of the then prosecutor who later became a judge. And so I guess my reaction, John, is as somebody who's been involved in the system since 1976, this is not, I don't think this is not a an extreme decision. There are always going to be factual disputes. And what I think you and Bill are arguing about is the extent to which Barbara's testimony was Was it really going to dismantle Jerry Trump, or was it just going to bruise him a little bit? How useful was that information? Because there's a second part of the inquiry. The first is, when you're looking at exculpatory material or Brady material, there are two aspects of it. One is it evidence that tends to show that the defendant was innocent, or as John said, deserves a lesser penalty because it goes to the degree of his involvement? But then the court on review decides materiality. And materiality is really the significance of the information that was not turned over. And this is a classic debate between John saying, I don't think it was that material. It may have been Brady material, but it wasn't that significant because it may have adversely affected his credibility, but it wasn't a game changer. Whereas Bill is saying, and the Court of Appeals said, no, we think it was clearly material. It was so significant that we think it undermines the testimony of Mr. Trump. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, I think, with this whole subject of Brady material. To the extent that there's a good prosecutor like John, and in fact the United States Supreme Court has said numerous times, the careful and prudent prosecutor turns over all that material, turns over all that information, all the Brady material, so that we're not into this post hoc, after the trial debate on its significance. Mm-hmm. It's turned over in a timely manner, and then the defense uses it, and the jury hears the information and then makes a decision whether or not it's critical or not. But to the extent that it's not turned over, then 9.5 years later, we find ourselves in this pickle, arguing about how significant it was or wasn't. That's the root cause.
Well, I discovered something on my Around the United States tour just recently, and it was a term that I would like to hear the two esteemed guests talk about if they'd like. It's called the open file system, which they have in Texas. We don't have that here in Missouri. If we had had the open file system, as I understand it, in Missouri, we would have known if Kim Bennett had testified and if her testimony was correct and if it had been put in. Whenever she was asked during the habeas hearing, well, why didn't you come to the court? She said, I told the police. I assumed it had been turned in. If you have the open file system like they have in Texas, she could have gone down to the courthouse and pulled up her own file to see if it was actually there. So if you have a system like you do in Columbia where the interviewee cannot get a copy of it, cannot read it, and doesn't get to sign it, then that is allowing abuse of the system. And I think if we change that, that would probably solve a lot of debates that John and I are having.
But it wouldn't happen in this case, because in this particular case there wasn't a report made.
Right. That's a problem in itself.
So you're open. I mean, your file could have been as open as you'd like, but it wouldn't have helped.
Sure.
But there was one with Kim Bennett.
Well, John is unfortunately – I mean, John, not it's unfortunate, but John, I think, is correct here, Bill, because they have an open file policy in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Bob Macy had an open file policy. But as John points out, if the police don't get the reports into the file, then the open file policy doesn't solve the problem. And Texas is leading the country in exonerations. So its open file policy it's not necessarily a panacea. I agree with you. I think that the more open discovery is, the more information that's turned over by the prosecutor, the less we get ourselves into this situation we now find ourselves. So I agree with you, but at the end of the day, I also agree with John. Just having an open file doesn't guarantee we're going
to
get
the information. We're going to have to take a quick break, though. We'll come right back to this after the break. A reminder, listeners, this is the intersection of program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're joined by Bill Ferguson, Rodney Uphoff, John Roadhouse, and Charles Atwell. I'm Ryan Familner. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Fumuller, and today we're talking about the Ryan Ferguson case. Last week, a court of appeals threw out Ferguson's conviction in the 2001 murder of Columbia Daily Tribune sports editor Kent Heitholt. Today, we're talking about the legal basis for why that conviction was vacated and some of the larger issues surrounding the conduct of prosecutors. Join me in studio for the conversation today are Bill Ferguson, the father of Ryan Ferguson, Rodney Uphoff, a professor in the MU School of Law and a former public defender, Attorney John Rudehouse, who in the past worked as a Boone County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney and as an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Missouri, and joining us by phone, Charles Atwell, is a practicing attorney who was formerly a circuit judge in Jackson County. And for you and our audience, what should be done to prevent wrongful convictions from happening? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia.
Ryan,
Charles, yes, go ahead.
I wanted to segue off of some of the comments that we've talked about, and I think that Rodney talked a lot about the idea of impeaching evidence being Brady, and I think that the Supreme Court has held since I think the early 80s in a case called Bagley that impeachment evidence does encompass the Brady concept, and I think this is a real problem in that. There are a lot of prosecutors, I think, who probably can understand that if they get evidence that directly shows someone else did the crime and is directly exculpatory, that to them is sometimes a different thing than this what we call impeaching evidence, because the impeaching evidence attacks the credibility of their case. And I really think one of the things that needs to happen is that prosecutors need to understand that the breadth of Brady and that it does affect impeaching evidence, and that impeaching evidence can result in injustice and can result in a set aside in this circumstance. And I think the thing that is that the public needs to understand in this regard also is that I really feel there's a lot of times where there's impeaching evidence is that rather than judge's materiality now, wouldn't it have been better to have disclosed it? And at the time when all the witnesses' memories are fresh, when the evidence is fresh, and it can be dealt with in the most appropriate way, and in some situations, if from a prosecutor point of view, if you don't give up this impeaching evidence, you run the risk of down the road is having someone exonerated or at least released, and you really don't have the ability to retry the case because of the fact it's old and the witnesses' memories fail and the like. So I think this impeaching evidence thing is really something that's not looked at a lot and is really a much bigger deal, and it should be on the forefront of training for prosecutors. Yeah. And I think it's where a lot of injustice occurs.
And just briefly, could you explain what impeaching evidence is again for the non-lawyers?
Well, impeaching evidence would be, in other words, a direct exculpatory evidence would be, you know, the defendant didn't commit this crime, John Jones committed this crime. But impeaching evidence would be if there's a witness saying John Jones committed the crime, but there's a statement where the witness, for example, like in Kyles versus Whitley, where he named someone else, or he had made inconsistent statements, and so that some of the key evidence is not near as believable as it was presented in the trial itself.
Well, I think he makes an excellent point, and this is one of the problems I think that I have with this case is that I agree that if it was in the prosecutor's possession, he should have erred on the side of turning it over. But in this particular case, you had a non-lawyer that had to make a determination as to whether this was impeachment evidence or not, because this never got to a lawyer's ears. And the way that the decision is written, in this case, we had an investigator who had a great deal of experience, and so we might expect him to be able to determine impeachment evidence from not. But what if this would have been just a call to a secretary or to the victim's advocate? The way that Brady has been interpreted, that would be imputed to the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's realistic for us to expect the staff of the prosecutor's office to be able to make on-the-spot legal determinations as to what is impeachment evidence or not as a matter of law. In fact, in this particular case, I would say as someone who's tried several cases myself that involve impeaching witness testimony, I would not have used Mrs. Trump, because if she were asked – if I were defending Ryan and if she were asked under oath – did you send this newspaper to your husband in jail? And she said, oh, I don't remember sending that newspaper. I don't remember that. That, I think, would be very counterproductive to my case. I mean, I would want someone that would say affirmatively, no, I did not send that newspaper. I have nothing to do with that. My husband never saw a newspaper in jail. So I think this decision does, I think, create a lot of problems going forward. It's not just your run-of-the-mill Brady case.
Well, but it's not the run-of-the-mill because of their evaluation. I mean, again, and I'm not a student of the case, but it's really an evaluation of the materiality of the situation. The fact that impeaching evidence is Brady has been established for a long time and should have been given up. I mean, we're parsing words and using legalisms, but I think that's really more like what we've got here.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was saying. I think the fight here is the significance of the material withheld. Although, John, I mean, I think what the court was doing in Kyles versus Whitley was trying to essentially send a clear signal, clear message to the prosecution that because this is a problem that we've seen over the years with material not getting the defense and there being various justifications, explanations for why that it didn't get there, it essentially is imposing almost a strict liability standard on the prosecutors, saying it's incumbent upon you, Mr. Prosecutor, to set up policies and procedures so that those decisions are made by not by the secretary or the witness advocate or the investigator, but the decision is ultimately made by the prosecutor. So the message that ought to go out is if you get calls from witnesses, put something down, send it to us, and then we'll let you know whether you need to file a complete report or whether or not we've got to do some additional checking. We as the prosecutors do additional checking before we need to turn something over. But I agree. We don't want the decisions made at the – you know, by the individual investigator. We want them to be made by the prosecutor, but we've got to get that information to the prosecutor so he or she can make the right decisions.
Right. Well, how does those types of disclosures, how does that actually happen here in Boone County, I guess, currently? How does that process actually work, those disclosures, when they're being presented to the defense?
That's the ex-prosecutor.
John.
Well, I can tell you what happens in your run-of-the-mill case,
okay.
And it is akin to an open file system. Essentially, there are certain documents that we are not permitted to disclose. I say we. I'm a criminal defense attorney now, but I'm slipping back into my right. past persona here for the show. There are certain documents that can't be turned over as far as criminal background documents,
sure.
And there's some information about witness information can't be given over. But sure, otherwise, privacy. Everything else, the policy is that the secretary – runs a photocopy of everything, puts a cover letter on the top. The prosecutor looks it over, signs it over. And any subsequent supplemental reports that come in, same way. I think it's actually when it comes into the office, a copy gets made for the prosecutor and the other copy goes directly to the defense attorney. Mm-hmm. Now, in a big case like this, I understand it may be different, and I can't really comment on that.
Sure.
I think the John, problem, and I think John has really identified a real – key systemic problem, and that is John identified the way it's handled probably in 90% of the prosecutor offices around the country. It's certainly the way it was handled in both Oklahoma and Wisconsin, where I practiced for quite a bit of time. The problem tends to be when there are supplemental reports or supplemental conversations that didn't generate a report. Those are the situations where you're more likely to get exculpatory material. But the individual investigators or police officers don't necessarily recognize this information as exculpatory because one of the key problems that keeps being identified in these exoneration cases, and I'm referring to the 311 DNA exonerations, there's more if you count other cases where a fair trial didn't necessarily happen. But in these exoneration cases, the problem is the police have fixated on a particular witness. And so they're hearing other information come in, but it's not consistent with their theory of the case. It's not consistent with their strong belief that John Jones was the murderer or the rapist or whatever. And so it never finds its way into the file because it seems irrelevant to them. And that's the root of the problem.
Yeah, and that's what some would say. The problem is an overzealous prosecutor. Is that part of the equation here? Or in some situations, they can't – I mean, again, some people are following the letter of law as they should, but this opens up that territory for someone like that.
Well, there certainly are cases of the overzealous prosecutor, the overzealous, where we actually have people who intentionally sometimes destroy or conceal exculpatory material. I'm identifying what I think is the more common problem, and that is the tunnel vision problem, mm-hmm. where they simply don't recognize the significance of this information because they're fixated on a particular person. So they're not necessarily, this is the classic, not necessarily acting out of bad faith. They just don't see the exculpatory nature of material. And then in hindsight, the defense lawyer or the court looks at this and goes, well, duh, it's so obvious this should have been turned over, but it just didn't seem that obvious at the time when the investigator or the police officer was looking at it. So those are two very different situations. Purposeful misconduct, hiding material, and then the failure to recognize the significance of the exculpatory material.
And in fairness to the courts, too, I'll say, is that they have recognized some limits to Brady. Probably the most common in Missouri is when the defense is otherwise knows of the information that has been failed to been disclosed. This was in the Salter case of Missouri Supreme Court, and then that was affirming Myers in an earlier decision, which basically says no harm, no foul. If the defense knew about the information through some other channel, the prosecutor may have committed a violation, but the point here is not to punish the prosecutor. Not the point is to see whether or not the defendant had due process in this trial. So I guess what I would like to see in a case like this one is let's acknowledge the fact that Mr. Trump was deposed prior to trial, that he spoke at his deposition about seeing this newspaper that his wife allegedly gave him. The defense had every opportunity to investigate this and to create its own impeachment case against Mr. Trump. And I think that to put the burden completely on the state using a hindsight analysis is just not realistic. We can disagree as to whether it was material or not. I don't think it was. You may think it was. But the fact is that there's no dispute that had a diligent attorney conducted the deposition and followed up on what was testified to at the deposition, the defense had every opportunity to know this information.
That's an interesting point, because I will say that this is a rare case. Now, Bill Ferguson and I may disagree on this, but the defense in Ryan's at Ryan's trial, it's one of the high-profile criminal defense lawyers from Kansas City. It was a team that was adequately resourced. It was a team that brought in Elizabeth Loftus, one of the country's leading expert witnesses. It's a much different kind of defense than you generally see in a lot of the wrongful conviction cases. So one of my problems is, and this is not focusing on Ryan Ferguson, but the larger systemic problem of the failure to turn over exculpatory material is we've got lots of public defenders with large caseloads mm-hmm. who don't have access to investigators, who don't really have the ability to use depositions because of their caseload problem. So their ability to discover this exculpatory material is in a much different position
yes.
than the Ferguson case. So I'd like to move off the Ferguson case if we could for
just a minute.
So. And
I feel your pain with that too, but I think that there's that same pressure on the state side, not in a big case like this, but in the run-of-the-mill case, you've got an assistant prosecutor with hundreds of cases. And like I said, in every trial, the prosecutor who's trying the case is getting a phone call from a witness that is starting to waver on whether they want to cooperate or not. Now, maybe something that they testified to before. Well, I don't remember. I don't know if that's what I said or not. Or I don't know if that's what I said or not. Do we need to make a memo every single time someone calls?
Charlie, what do you think about that situation? If I come in front of you as a judge and I have a prosecutor who got a witness who previously said in their police report, I'm 100% sure that the defendant is the guy. Now they've made a call to John, and during that call, they're now retreating, and they're saying, I'm really not sure. Doesn't John have a statutory and constitutional obligation to memorialize that and turn that over to me?
He certainly has. I believe he has an obligation to turn it over for sure.
What if by the end of the phone call, the witness has acknowledge the fact that, okay, I'm going to go through with it. I'm going to show up. Do you really need me to testify? Okay, I'll show up.
See, I think there's a big difference between wavering in terms of their enthusiasm for testifying, which I bet happens pretty commonly,
mm-hmm. right.
and they're saying they're now not sure that the person that they once said was 100% sure. Now they're saying, hey, I think –
But those
to be
two
honest,
go hand in glove. They go hand in glove because they know that the way that they can get out of testifying is if, okay, well, if I don't say what the prosecutor wants me to say, maybe he won't make me testify.
But that,
I think Charles. There's two – one is they're not – is the one – question, is there an obligation to produce? And I think good practice suggests yes. Okay? And then the other area is, again, we can get back to this materiality. In other words, did it make a difference? And I think that's the other thing that Rodney talked about. In the Kyle's case, not only did they suggest that prosecutors need to investigate beyond their own knowledge, but I think a fair reading of Kyle's is that they lessened the materiality standard because they were seeing a lot of these Brady violations.
All right. I do want to take a moment to remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuelner, and today we're talking about the Ryan Ferguson case. Last week, a court of appeals threw out Ferguson's conviction in the 2001 murder of Columbia Daily Tribune sports editor Kent Heitholt. Today we're talking about the legal basis for that conviction, why it was vacated, and some of the larger issues surrounding the conduct of prosecutors. Joining me in studio for the conversation today are Bill Ferguson, the father of Ryan Ferguson, Rodney Uphoff, a professor in the MU School of Law and former public defender, Attorney John Ruthouse, who in the past worked as a Boone County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney and an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Missouri. And joining us by phone, Charles Atwell, is a practicing attorney who was formerly a circuit judge in Jackson County. And for you and our audience, do you think prosecutors should be punished if they commit a Brady violation? Let us know by giving us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And that actually question goes well with a comment we did get from a guest in the chat room. Says, what should be done to prevent Brady violations from happening? Hold prosecutors responsible. Maybe let's start with Charles on this, since Charles is on the phone. What do you think about that sort of that sentiment, Charles?
Well, I think that if there are Brady violations, I think that if someone commits an obvious Brady violation, that it's certainly at a minimum that person should, that office should be slow to use that person in a sensitive situation again, or at least should be very cautious about it. Prosecutors do have, for the most part, civil immunity on these things, so there's not really a basis to sue them or get compensation for them. The one classic example is there was based on all these exonerations that occurred in Illinois on the death penalty, you know, all the death penalty exonerations. There was actually a prosecution of several of prosecutors and court officials in a place called DeKalb County, which is just, I believe, just to the west of Chicago. And there were prosecutions. Those defendants happened to have been acquitted, but that did occur in one occasion.
But that is pretty rare, right? I mean, there aren't a lot of systematic practices.
And sadly, what happens sometimes is there are prosecutors today that have committed Brady violations, maybe minor ones or maybe ones that you know, didn't result in an injustice, but they're still prosecuting. There are folks like that now. There are also, but to segue what I think Rodney said is, I have seen circumstances where prosecutors have produced Brady evidence and have been the main movers in exonerating folks. That has happened. I've been involved in two particular ones where it did happen.
Sure, I think that's a really important part, Charlie, because. I'm certainly not trying to suggest, and I don't think John and Charlie are trying to suggest either, that prosecutors are always the bad guys who are always violating the rules, because as I opened up by saying, the vast majority of prosecutors follow the rules, play by the rules, and do their job appropriately. And Charlie's exactly right. There are examples of prosecutors who have reopened cases, and they've been the main engineers of exonerations. But the systemic problem is, how do we deal with those prosecutors who aren't playing by the rules and are violating the rules? And as the criminal justice system has not done a very good job in policing those prosecutors. If you look around the country, there are very few instances where professional misconduct has been levied against prosecutors. Not in the close calls. I'm talking about the egregious cases, as the example in Texas. That's a rare, rare instance where a prosecutor has been disbarred. The Duke LaCrosse rape case is another one where Mike Nifong was disbarred for his egregious concealing of evidence. But civil liability is not a route, because currently most of the laws in the country provide virtually absolute immunity, virtually, for prosecutors despite their misconduct. we don't want to get ourselves, unfortunately, in the dilemma of having to choose between holding them accountable or dismissing cases. I mean, I think we've got to find a mechanism, and I think it's through the professional disciplinary committees that ought to be holding prosecutors accountable when there's a clear violation of the rules.
I'm going to go ahead and bring in, we have a caller on the line, Carolyn from Columbia. Carolyn, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thanks for calling in today.
Yes, I just wanted to say, partly speaking as a citizen, but I have to admit I'm also an attorney and give a disclaimer that I can't possibly say that I know all the details of the case. But it is my impression that there have been so many problems with the witnesses and so many recurring problems with the evidence that bringing this whole case back around to the Brady issue is the right thing to do, because it appeared to me it was not beyond a reasonable doubt. And as for prosecutors, I think in Boone County we're blessed with basically a very good team of prosecutors. But yes, it is a nationwide problem, and something needs to be figured out to close the loopholes where evidence is not brought forward or not logged into the file, or et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a lot that's being said that's very valuable here today. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Carolyn, very much for calling in. Bill, I wanted to give you a chance to jump in. You've been trying to many times this half hour. A lot going on.
Yeah, and some of those points have come and gone. But I think, can I help but think, you had, I think someone said in Chicago that there were 300 some odd people that were exonerated. You know, it seems like to me if you have 300 people that were exonerated, the prosecutor either knew or should have known that there was a problem. That's a problem. I think that we're on the brink of the Enlightenment period of examining prosecutors a lot closer, because I think they've been getting a free go for a long, long time. When we talk about setting a mechanism in to make sure this doesn't happen, we definitely need to do that. And they're not being diligent in the running of their offices unless they do that. And I was asked in New York in an interview, they said, what do you suggest we could do to bring this about? And I suggested said if you would find a prosecutor has done something egregious, and I don't think that's very hard to do, and send him to prison, not 10 days like in Anderson's case, send him to prison for 5, 10, 15 years or what happens to be, I think that that would have a cooling effect on misbehavior. And I just don't want to hear people justifying the prosecutors and hedging things and so on and so forth. We've got too many people doing that. Let's look at the guts of the case. Some of them are absolute pure liars. Not all of them. Take, for example, the JonBenet case. Two prosecutors there initially, whenever the grand jury wanted an indictment, they said no. The prosecutor said no. And whenever Mark David Carr admitted that he was there when the murder took place in Singapore, and flew him into Colorado and found out he'd never been there before, they never pursued that. If that had been in Boone County, he'd be in prison right now.
Well, John? In all due respect to Mr. Ferguson, I mean, I don't have the personal stake in this case as he does and with the Boone County Prosecutor's Office like he does. But that's just a fairy tale, what he just described. I mean, the prosecutors don't act like that on a widespread level. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head in the state of Missouri. I think in the past 10 years, there have been 3 or 4 cases reversed. I mean, Rod would probably know better. Less than 10 cases have been reversed on Brady violations in the past 10 years. So, I mean, this idea that we have this widespread national problem of prosecutorial misconduct is really just a fairy tale.
You wouldn't call 300 in Chicago a wide problem? That's insignificant?
Again, I don't know what we're even referring to when we're talking about 300 in Chicago.
I thought you said
that was in the intro, and that I don't think that it was a Chicago Tribune article. But I'll tell you what, from here, I want to move. We have a few minutes left. Why don't we jump into this question, because it might be a good summary question here. We talked a little bit about holding our prosecutors accountable and how that's kind of tricky because of immunity. What could be done to try to fend off more Brady violations? If that cooling effect is a difficult one to come by, what else can be done at this point in the game?
Well, I think the most effective way to hold prosecutors accountable is through the boards of professional misconduct in the individual jurisdictions. And some jurisdictions are more aggressive in going after prosecutors than other jurisdictions. Oklahoma was a place I'm very familiar with. The prosecutors down there could pretty much do whatever they wanted to do. The chief prosecutor in Oklahoma County was found by the Tenth Circuit to have lied in court in a death penalty case. They overturned the death penalty case, found that he, as I said, he lied to the court during the proceeding. Well, if a criminal defense lawyer or a civil lawyer lied during a proceeding to the court, you can bet they're very likely to have some discipline, either at a minimum a reprimand, but more likely suspension if they were caught lying in court. That prosecutor, nothing happened to him, and that's unfortunately too common.
Exactly.
What I would say to John is Steve Weinberg, who's in this journalism school. Mm-hmm. Did a national study on the problem of prosecutorial misconduct, focusing a lot on Brady. And while he wouldn't say it is as widespread as Bill suggests, he wouldn't also say it was as rare as John suggests. It is a national problem. The fact that there aren't as many convictions overturned doesn't really get to the bottom line, because many times convictions aren't overturned based on materiality. Mm-hmm. The court says, yeah, there may have been a Brady violation, but it wasn't significant enough here. And that's post hoc analysis, and that's a problem. We don't want to put our courts in the position of having to make this after-the-fact determination. It's much better and more appropriate for this material to be turned over. And if a prosecutor isn't turning it over, whether it's material or not, he or she's not meeting their obligation, and there ought to be some consequences. And if there's no consequences, then this problem will continue to fester. So yeah, we've got to deal with it.
And ultimately, it's an issue of fairness, right? That's the whole point here, right? Charles, sorry, I think you wanted to jump in there a moment ago.
Well, I was going to say, kind of consistent with what Rodney was saying, is I think this idea of the trying to hook this into the canons of ethics is something that really should be done, and we should. I mean, I think it's a great suggestion. There was the Champion, which is the magazine for the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, did an article on Brady in May of 2013 that highlighted such cases as Senator Stevens' case and some other noteworthy cases. And one of the authors in that case was actually Barry Scheck, and an ex-judge named Nancy Gertner suggested that all Brady motions should also include reference to the canons of ethics and require the prosecutor to respond to specific sections of the canons of ethics so that if there is a non-disclosure, you've got that situation set up.
I used to do that in all my Brady motions, Charles.
Yeah.
but that's not a practice. A common practice is not something that's required.
No.
No. So, actually is all the time that we have. So I'm going to have to cut us off there. But I want to say thank you very much for listening today. That's it for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Bill Ferguson, Ryan Ferguson's father, Rodney Uphoff, a professor in the MU School of Law and a former public defender, attorney John Roothouse, a former prosecuting attorney, and Charles Atwell is a practicing attorney who was formerly a circuit judge in Jackson County who joined us by phone today. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan's our technical director, with production assistance from Casey Morrell and Andrew Yost. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.